So I think I'm pretty safe these days because people know me now. They know I tell silly jokes every now and again, but that's just showing that you're human and that you can entertain people, make people see the funny side of life, even the funny side of meditation life, which is a beautiful thing to be able to do. When you see that too many people are serious, that turns you off whatever you're doing. And it means that people are so serious, it's not pleasant to be with them. And hopefully this last 8 or 9 days, it's been very pleasant to see everybody. You've got to know each other's faces, you can smile at them, and sometimes talk in the cottages or whatever you do, look after one another. It's like a family of meditators. And there is some bonding goes on there. I know that many people after a retreat, they exchange emails, and if they live in the same city, they could visit each other for a cup of coffee, and when they have a cup of tea or coffee in their favourite shop, they always remember that story of if you're invited by one of your friends, they call you up, are you free this afternoon? And you said, yes. Would you like to come for a cup of coffee? I've found this great coffee shop and I really like it. I know you prefer tea, but I like coffee, so come to the coffee shop. And I know you like what are all these ones? Flat whites, but I like latte. So we're going to have a latte, and we're going to sit in the back, not in the front where you like to sit. And we're going to have a muffin with it, not a piece of toast. Do you have toast in coffee shops? Anyway, we're going to have a muffin. I know you don't like muffins, but I like muffins, so you're eating a muffin. And we're going to talk about politics. All this Buddhism rubbish, that's not important. The politics in the world, that defines our economies and people's lives. People get in jail because they got the wrong politics. This is the future of our planet. We've got to talk about this. And if you're invited to a cup of coffee like that, what would you do? In their story, I say, then you think, yeah, I've really got to go to the dentist. I got a dentist appointment at that time. I'm terribly sorry, I can't go. Because no one wants to go and have a cup of coffee or whatever with a control freak, tells you what to eat, when to eat, how to eat, what to talk about. That's like almost a definition of a control freak. So you make an appointment with the dentist to keep your 5 precepts. A bit of a problem with the time, but time is impermanent. And now if you made the appointment with the dentist, you get another call from this really nice friend. And he said, I've just come back from Ajahn Brahm's retreat. Do you like to come out for a cup of coffee? And you say, cup of coffee? Yeah, I know, I don't usually like coffee, but I know you do. I've got this lovely coffee shop I've found. I've never been there, and I know you like the coffee. And they have all sorts of coffee, whatever coffee you like. And I know you always like to sit in the back, but we can sit in the front or the back, wherever you want. I'll sit where you sit. And what would you like to eat with your coffee? And what would you like to talk about? Especially, you've just gone on this retreat. I'd really love to know how it works. What is meditation? What is Buddhism? And when it's somebody who goes to where you like to go, sit where you like to sit, drink what you like to drink, eat what you like to eat, and talk about what interests you, what would you do? He said, I'm going. I'll be there. And then you ring up the, the dentist, I'm sorry, I'm cancelling to keep your 5 precepts. When you go to the lovely coffee shop, and you've only got an hour to spend, but if it's with someone you really like, drinking what you like to drink, eating what you like to eat, you spend all afternoon there. Time flies by. Which means you've learned how to meditate. You ask your mind, what would you like to meditate on? How long would you like to meditate? Would you like to sit, or you want to walk, or you want to lie down on the bed? How would you like to position your body? And what would you like to eat? There's a great meditation we've got on offer, first jhana, or second jhana, or third jhana. Which one would you like? And if it's somebody who's that kind to you, and if you don't get any jhanas at all, I say, oh, never mind, it's just nice to spend time with you, mind. Then, of course, you can stay for long periods of time. If you tell the mind what to do, have expectations, tell it how to sit, how long to sit, what you have to do, what you can't do, now you can understand why you get a wandering mind. It doesn't last that long. So anyway, that's the idea of like fellowship, kindness. That's the trick of like being sustaining attention on something. Your mind and you are just really, really good friends. That's why you always get a bit sad at the end of a retreat, because now you have to go travelling, get in the vehicles, go and see other people. It's much more busy. I don't really feel that. You know why I don't really feel when a retreat ends? I don't feel sad. Because this afternoon I'll go in my cave and I'll be meditating in there. For a monk, the meditation never stops, which is the beautiful part of being a monk. That's why when I have to sign books, I don't mind. Because after you sign books, you can go into your cave and just disappear. The whole idea of disappearing. That, you know, the more I try to disappear, the more that people try and find me. You understand what that means? There's very few people in this world who can disappear and don't really worry what other people think about them. And if you find somebody like that, lots of people just go there and want to be there. It's something weird and strange. That's, of course, one of the reasons I still find it difficult to understand why many people want to take a photograph of monks. We're not the most beautiful people in the world. We're not like Brad Pitt or the nuns. With respect, you're not like Angelina Jolie. Please don't sue me for that. But did I get the people right? Brad Pitt, Angelina, they're a bit old, aren't they? They're not, okay, never mind. But I kind of like to, things I don't understand, I always like to try and focus on. Why do people like to take photographs of monks and nuns? Not just one, but many. And I think the only thing can be is that even though you're old, sometimes the kindness, the softness that people can see in that photograph, and my stupid smile. When you make a stupid smile, that's the, you know, you don't care if people like it, don't like it, get offended or don't get offended. And that kind of is quite attractive. It's like a freedom. You're not burdened by what other people think of you. And when that happens, it means you've got a sense of freedom, which a lot of other people don't have. Are you worried what other people think of you? And always trying to please other people? If you are, that's an extra stress. You don't have to please anybody. Certainly not in this retreat. I mean, I'm sure that some of you have had some very stupid meditations. You've been sleeping all the time. I said sleep in the first few days. But after the first few days, you still want to sleep. So you justify it by saying you're doing Ananda meditation. You know, when I was a young monk, please excuse me if I said this stories before, but I'm always giving talks. I don't know what talk I gave here, what talk I gave over in Bodhinyana, what talk I gave in Indonesia a week or two ago. But this was a story. We used to have to sit meditation all night once a week. Couldn't go to bed. Just on the moon nights. So sometimes that was tough. And so as a young monk, I remember, I felt really tired. So I sneaked back to my room and lay down. I was only going to lay down just to stretch the body, but it happens all the time. As soon as your head hits a pillow, you know, you're out of control. You know, you always know it's out of control, so you just go to sleep. And when someone catches you, you're asleep. What's happened? And I used to use the excuse, I had an attack from Mara. look, I'm only a young monk, I'm just starting out. Now, Mara defeated many, many monks and nuns. I'm only starting. What hope do I have against Mara? So when I thought this was Mara, I knew I was going to lose, so I just... I just had to sleep anyway. I invented that, but after a while all the other monks in the monastery were using that excuse. But interestingly, about those all-night meditations, that after a while, you know, you could actually get some nice meditation. I had some of the very, very best meditations on those all-night meditations. You'd really get very, very deep. And I always knew it was a good meditation. I've already mentioned once about what happens when you have a really deep meditation. You've got so much energy afterwards. And I know this, I'm not faking this, because when we do the chanting, Yo So Bhagavan, really loud. And the other monk said, be quiet. And I couldn't. Just too much energy. That's a nice feeling. You understand where the energy comes from. It's not just, you know, logic or science. You know, you haven't slept, but you've got this great mental energy inside of you, and that's much stronger than any physical energy. So it's wonderful to experiment like that and find out what this body of mine can actually do and strange things it does. And hopefully you've experienced some of the strangeness when the mind becomes really powerful, very strong, blissful, and how it can do all these incredible things, like, you know, the hot spots in the body and healing stuff. And I did already tell the story about that man who had a throat cancer and was always like breathing loudly. I did that one already, didn't I? No. Okay. This was in Sydney when I taught a retreat over there. And the first day and the question time, half of the questions were exactly the same. They say, Ajahn Brahm, can you please tell people in the meditation hall to breathe quietly. One of the weirdest questions. Breathe quietly. You understand what it meant, because this gentleman, middle to late age, male, Caucasian, he was breathing really loud. Not just three breaths like that, but continually. That's when I had to let people know that that gentleman has got this big tumour in his sinus. He can't breathe through his nose. He can only breathe through his mouth. And he wasn't even a Buddhist. But he knew that meditation has its reputation of, like, overcoming these diseases. So he wanted to give it a try. His doctors had all given up on him, so they've only got a few weeks to go to before you die. But so he had nothing to lose, so he came on the retreat. Now, retreats are great. They're always really good and very cheap. That's why I always say, if it doesn't work for you, you can always ask for your money back. Is that okay? Well, oh, the Nadia's in the back. Has anyone asked for their money back yet? Please, I tell everybody, they can actually quote, Ajahn Brahm said, you can always ask for your money back. Okay? You won't get it back, but you can always ask. So anyway, nothing to lose. So he's meditating. I think I must have told that story, because at the end of the retreat, that's when he was still breathing loudly, nothing had worked. But the very last meditation, I mean the last meditation, this is not the last meditation yet. I was in the car about to drive off to Sydney Airport, be driven to Sydney Airport, and this guy came running to me. Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm. I heard this popping sound. So no need to run. After here I go to Bodhinyana Monastery, you can come over there and tell me that something happened. I heard this popping sound, pop. And he could breathe through his nose. Only for a minute, and then it closed up again. And he was really excited. You can imagine, what it must be like, you know, you got a death sentence on you, you're going to die from cancer very soon. You tried everything, nothing works. And then suddenly you can breathe through your nose when you're meditating. But it closes up again afterwards. I thought it was too late for him, honestly. But I said, carry on, keep on going. That encouraged him. He had something to motivate him to carry on meditating. And I didn't know what happened, because 6 months later, I don't live in Sydney, but 6 months later I was giving another talk in Sydney. And that's when I saw this other guy. He looked like another guy. And he came up to me and said, do you remember me? Look, it's impossible I can remember each one of you. Yeah, I spent 9 days with you, 60-plus people over here. But then we have a range retreat. We have, I don't know how many more people in this retreat center. And then I go to another retreat. You go to Sri Lanka, and there's 3,000, 4,000 people in this BMICH. And that's also in Indonesia. And sometimes people come up to me. Yeah, I saw you in Colombo, in BMICH. Do you remember me? I said, look, there's another 5,000 people there. How do you expect me to remember you? Anyway, I said, I don't remember him. That's the trouble, I'm honest. And sometimes people get upset. What do you mean you don't remember me? You know, I've been looking after, I'm one of your monks. Oh, yeah. Anyway, this guy, you know, he smiled. He realized it was a silly question to ask. But he smiled. He said, I was that guy. And it was really a lovely experience, because he looked totally different than a person who's dying of cancer, as you would expect. And he said, it's in full remission now. That meditation worked. Got him from a last stage cancer, no hope, no treatment possible, to be able to see it vanish and change his life. Actually, it didn't change his life, it changed his death. In other words, the death never happened. And he said he was just going to spend the rest of his life out of gratitude. He understood. You don't need to say thank you to me if I've helped you at all. He said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life teaching this to others. That's a paying it forward. So if I've helped you in any which way, then help somebody else. And if I've upset you and given you a hard time, pay it forward. Go and irritate somebody else with bad jokes. You've got to be consistent. So anyway, this is actually how we enjoy this wonderful practice of Dhamma, and actually how we grow from it. And growing is slowly. You plant a tree, a lot of times you'll never see the tree go to its fullness. But you plant it there, and it takes a long time. But then eventually it starts growing. Over in that monastery in Thailand, there was one part of the monastery, it was just really infertile. I think it was just too much water there, and the water just dragged all the nutrients away. And so it was right next to our monastery, so the owner decided to sell it to us very cheaply, because it was a useless piece of land. Nothing would grow on it. But now we started putting some trees in there, planting some jackfruit trees and some mango trees. And it, for years, nothing happened. We kept on putting fertilizer on it and trying to look after it. And then suddenly, I think it must have been the roots, you know, hit the water table underneath the ground. And then they grew so quickly within a year or two. I never thought I'd see the result of those trees which we planted and taken lots of water and other stuff there. But it did. One of the things which we did put on those trees, again, I'm consistent with my stories. I did, you know, because I had a science background, I did want to do something, you know, for the monastery to make it useful for the villagers to learn something. So we had a methane generator, you know, from the toilets. You know, I read about this, apparently in mainland China they were using this quite a lot to create enough energy to help run their villages when it's too far away from any electricity. And you got some of the cow dung, lots of water buffaloes there, put it in this machine, and then, not really a machine, but just a place where it could get warm, and all the methane would come out. And we'd use that methane to cook with. And I remember doing that, and all the remnants from that was excellent fertilizer. And that was like the feces, you know, from the monks and the visitors and the buffalo. And that went on those mango trees. It took a lot of that to be able to get those mangoes and jackfruits to grow. But it wasn't just ordinary feces. I said, you know, this is one of the most powerful fertilizers in the world. It's called holy shit. Now you know where that word comes from. Holy shit. And you ate some of those mangoes. And you ate some of those mangoes and jackfruit, and they're delicious all the time. Because there's no other fertilizer there which could be used, and so we use this one. And it worked. So, but all that hard work for, you know, for many years, you never think you'll see the fruit of that. You think those trees are growing too slowly. You think your meditation is growing too slowly. It's never going to work. It's going to take too much time. But then, suddenly it starts to, it's like the roots hit the water table. And there's a big boost of growth. That's like with your meditation. A big boost of growth. And that's usually what happens. Sometimes people think they've been meditating for a long time, they're hopeless. But one thing I can tell you, that you can never forget this meditation practice. It's already too late. You've been brainwashed. And it's hard to unbrainwash that out of your practice, out of your life. There's something about the meditation which kind of tastes sweet. You may not have much of it, but this is interesting. There's something pure about this. It's nothing you have to take drugs for. It's nothing you have to pay for. Any payments or donations, that's all to keep the retreat center going. It's not for me. I don't receive anything I've ever received from this place is cups of tea. That's why I always say that a monk or a nun who teaches is very good value for money. Just one cup of tea, it's amazing what you get out of that. So nevertheless, it's a practice which you can never forget. You know, there's many people who were monks before. They disrobe for some reason, and they come back. It's amazing how many people just, they try and live a life outside the monastery, and they just, it's okay, but it's not good enough. Not like sort of what they can kind of taste. They haven't eaten the food yet, but they taste it and it brings them back again. You don't force anybody. I mean, what is really valuable in your life? What is the most valuable thing you've ever tasted in your life? And there's something about this meditation, this insight, this peace, which is basically irresistible. It's something which is personal. You don't need to believe what other people say or do. You can do it in your own way, in your own time. There's a sense of freedom there. And you mention these little things like the two freedoms, the freedom of desire and the freedom from desire. You may not have experienced that, but it makes so much sense. The idea of being peaceful, really peaceful, no matter what age you are. The idea of being still. I know many people want an easy life. I remember these Indians, they told me the story of one of their relations. He was really lazy. He was so demanding. You know, any job he did had to be, you know, what he wanted. But eventually, because they looked after their family and friends, they got him a job in a restaurant. They just serve him food, that's all. Nice and easy. no real stress. But then after half a day he said, I can't stand this. It's way too stressful. Why? You don't have to worry, just give the food, put it on table number two. He said, oh, I saw all these people eating delicious food and I couldn't eat any of it. That was so stressful for me. So they said, okay, we'll give you the job as a cashier. You don't have to look at any food. So I said, I'll try that. So they put him in the cashier's box and he couldn't see the food from there. So he never saw any food, he just received the money from the customers. After half a day he said, I can't do that anymore either, it's too stressful. What's stressful? You don't see any food. Yeah, but I see the money and I can't have any of it. I have to put it in the till and give it to the boss. That's really stressful, seeing all the money and I can't have any of it. So it's really a hard case. So they finally found him the perfect job. He was the attendant at the cemetery. He doesn't have to receive any food, doesn't receive any money, doesn't see any food. All he needs to do is to sit there in a little box and just to watch when people go in and go out. They don't do anything illegal or anything, which they usually don't do. But you need just a guard there, just on the gate. And then after one day of doing that, he said, it's too stressful. What do you mean? What's stressful about just being a guard watching people going in and out of the cemetery? It wasn't the people who go in and out which made me stressful. It's just all the corpses in that cemetery. They were all lying down and I had to sit up. Some people are so demanding. So yeah. Anyway, where was I? I don't know where I was, actually, to be honest. But nevertheless, sometimes some of these meditations, they're kind of like attractive and they pull you in, which is a wonderful thing to do. It's a promise, and many promises which you have in life, promises of happiness, promises of safety, promises of comfort, some of those promises never actually meet what they say they're going to give you. One of the stories which really shocked me when I was young was a story about this guy. He was in the United States, you know, in the roaring 20s. He made a huge amount of money. And after making a big pile of money, he thought, this is enough. So he didn't keep any investments. He decided, I can move to any place in the world now and build a big house and have enough money there to look after myself to my dying days. And so he went to the library and he wanted to find a place with a perfect climate, nice and peaceful. He liked sort of the ocean, so he wanted to be close to the sea. And he found this island which no one had ever heard about in the Solomon Islands, in the Pacific. Beautiful climate, beautiful scenery, nice beaches, no problems at all. And he moved there in the late 20s. And it was the island in the Solomon Islands called Guadalcanal. Yeah. Okay, he remembers that. There were two major battles of the war there. The Japanese invading and then the Americans invading the Japanese. Big battles. And this poor guy went there for an idyllic peace. And he was in the middle of two major battles. He actually survived, which was a miracle. But I think he said he would have been much quieter if he'd stayed in Los Angeles. So you never know. The future can promise you all sorts of things but doesn't fulfill it. But then, with the meditation, the peace, it's something much more powerful. It's like you can stay anywhere. Like whatever happens, you can be peaceful. Because you're training your mind. Not what's outside, but what's inside. And that's always the case. You can't control the world, but you can always control your reactions to the world. You can let it be. I already mentioned to you some of the great physical pains which I've had. You can let go, and it's crazy, but the pain disappears. You've had very bad fevers, typhus fever. And you can just let go of everything and just bliss out in meditation. I mean, really blissing out, and that was fantastic. You could do that from a place of zero energy. It's amazing what people can do. I still remember how Ajahn Chah said that he overcame his malaria fever. Because malaria fever for forest monks, that was, you know, par for the course. You know, you're living in the forests, in the jungles of Thailand, and you'd always get bitten by mosquitoes. So eventually you get malaria. So most of those forest monks had malaria. And he said in one of his talks, he had a very bad episode of malaria. But then he thought, you know, why fight this? So what he did, he just sat in meditation during the fever. Very hot. He sat in meditation and he went inside. I keep on saying this, go inside of things. Don't try and get away from it. Don't go over there, or find a place where the fever or the pain doesn't exist. Go inside. So he went right into the center. And then he described it just like being in the center of a forest fire. Like the whole forest was on fire, getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. But he was in the middle. And in the middle, he said he felt no heat at all. Just like the eye of a storm. In the middle, it was cool. But he knew it was getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And hotter and hotter and hotter. He never tried to restrain it or do anything, just let it get hot. And as it got hotter outside, but where he was cool. And then it exploded. It got so hot, boom. And that was the end of his fever. Forever. He never got sick again. Not with malaria fever. I kind of like that idea. You just go deep inside where sort of whatever sickness is bothering you, and it disappears. He did it, that's how he told me. But anyway, that's the power of meditation. And I think you trust me. I've got nothing to gain about telling fibs or exaggerating. So hopefully you trust that all these stories I say actually happened. And so because of that, it gives you this interest in this power of meditation. And above all things, above all the other parts of Buddhism, the meditation is something you can experience, and it's very clear and powerful. Yeah, we do have the other things like the virtuous practices and also the the views on what life is all about and many lives. I should have mentioned that one of the reasons I've asked some of you who have some good meditation, can you remember your previous lives? What's your earliest memory? One of the reasons I ask you to do that is because these days that people believe, oh, yeah, how can you prove, that there is such a thing as rebirth? Give us a scientific evidence. But when enough people can recall their past lives, and if you can recall those past lives, you can check them out. They're true. There's evidence now. People take many records if it's a recent life, so you can find out if it's real or not. And that actually gives you the confidence that past lives actually happen and future lives happen. Even just what I was saying yesterday, yesterday, when the family came to talk about their father's unexpected death. And it was really helpful to tell everybody, including the kids, about rebirth. And now what might happen? That sometimes that's they already saw their mother after she died. Because I told them, do you want to see her? Make a resolution, I'd love to see her. And of course, they did. And that was actually quite amazing to see the mind made body. Not a ghost, they weren't scared. I'd explained it to them beforehand. It's marvelous that those things happen. But nothing was as beautiful as that story of this English man. His name was Peter. And he was skeptical about everything. But he had some confidence in Buddhism. And anyway, he lived just very close to our modern present center in Nolamara, literally just around the corner. And so one day, he was in bed at night, and he woke up in the middle of the night. Sometimes you realize something's happening. electricity in the air, or whatever you call it. And anyway, he put his bedside lamp on, and it was his mother who was coming to visit him. But she lived in Essex, and this was in Perth. And when he put the light on, she was standing at the end of his bed. As clear, as he said to me, as I am looking at you right now. Not some hazy picture, not some sort of floating, cloudy, foggy picture, but really clear. And he was so happy to see his mum. Now, she was over in England, he was in Australia, and his mum was standing at the end of the bed. And she was smiling at him. And, you know, if you've got a good relationship with your mother, and she comes and visits you smiling at you, that meant so much to him. He said at the time, he realized she must have died. This was a ghost, a spirit had come to visit him. And all they did was look at each other, just smiling with the only sort of expression of love which a mother can give to her son, and son back to her mum. Quiet, silent. For about 5 or 6 minutes, he said. Well, after those 5 or 6 minutes, then she just faded away, just vanished. Didn't go out, just the image just disappeared. And he never felt scared for 1 minute. How can you feel scared when that's your mother come to see you? You haven't seen her for a few months. And she smiles at you like that, a visit from someone who was so loving. So he was English. So what do English people do in such situations? There's a couple of English people. They get up and make a cup of tea. I don't know why they make a cup of tea, but they do anyway, middle of the night. And he made himself a cup of tea. And then the phone rang, as he said, and it was his sister over in London. Pete, I've got some bad news for you. Yeah, I know, Mum's dead. And his sister was shocked. How on earth did you know that? We've just come back from the hospital. He said, oh, she's just come to visit me. It's real. And how wonderful, how meaningful, how lovely that was. He had a visit from his mum after she died. I think if you've lost a parent you really loved or someone you really liked, it would be wonderful to have that sort of experience. It was real true. So those are the sorts of things which make this practice of meditation, these teachings of the Buddha, this kindness, and understanding the bigger picture, not just a body, but a mind as well, and the mind can do such things. It makes it very fascinating. And the evidence is all there, it's not just bare belief. It's a wonderful freedom. If you don't want to believe that, fine. You can still come on retreats to jhana growth. We have all sorts of people come on these retreats to jhana growth. We don't give you a questionnaire, what's your view, before you come to jhana growth. Everyone is welcome, because you know, you don't need to prove anything by fear or by force, by compulsion. It's all out there for you to experiment for yourself and find out what's true. And that becomes sort of what you've been learning. I always wanted to say, there's a couple of things which I always forget to say, but this time I remember. I have taught to a very high standard on this retreat, taught things like jhanas and nimittas. And sometimes people complain to me. They say, look, this is my first meditation retreat. So why do you teach nimittas? It's way too much for me. And then I sort of answer them. When I set the standards so high, nimittas and jhanas, each one of you get much higher as you know, you understand this is what's possible. And it draws you much more peaceful than you've ever been before. And one day, I don't know if you can come back again, or things happen in your life and you go to other countries, other places, but you can't forget those things. And eventually just that seed which is planted will actually bear fruit. the very least, have I said already that when you die, you see these beautiful lights in the mind, and you go towards the light. That's what happens when a person dies. And now you actually have some idea of that light which you see when the five senses stop, you know, quite permanently. You know exactly what it is, you know what to do. You don't control. Let it be. Be in this moment, don't be afraid, don't be excited. And that will enhance that experience for you. You'll never be afraid. So those are the reasons why I teach like this. Give everything I possibly can. And some of you, surprisingly, do get very deep meditations. Every time it's always one or two, get a jhana or nimittas or something. And that gives me so much inspiration. Even if only one person ever got a jhana, I'd still teach my butt off for them. It's such a beautiful experience. It's opening the doors of enlightenment to you. As it says, verse 372 of the Dhammapada, Nati jhānaṁ apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi jhānaṁ ca panya ca sa vai nibbāna santike. You all understand that, don't you? Know what it means. There is no wisdom without jhāna. There's no jhāna without wisdom. Turn it the other way around. But in the one who has jhāna and wisdom, they are in the presence of nibbāna. Sarve nibbāna santike. They're right next to it. Those two, the jhāna and the wisdom. It's like the jhāna is the light, the flashlight. The wisdom is the map. If you have the flashlight and the map, you'll actually find yourself to the treasure, nibbāna. That's how it works. Many of you got enough knowledge, wisdom. But the thing which most people are lacking is like the power of the mind, the jhana. Okay, so that's 9 o'clock. So now we have, I shouldn't call it toilet break, letting go break. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now I know that there aren't that many toilets, so those who want to bow quickly and get out there first of all, then you won't have to queue. Are you ready? On your marks, go! Toilet break. I'm trying to come back by 9:15 so we can do the loving kindness meditation.